Uidamu, Heart of the Pocasets, page 47 through 62. The next day. Well, the coatman house proved to be a coat woman's house, after all. I peeped eagerly through the gap in the fence of the English garden. I do not know the names and the uses of most of these coatman plants, but I am very curious about them. I recognized some things growing there. There were pale green plants with fleshy leaves, big and round as a man's head like this. Growing in a box right under my nose was something low and fragrant and very sweet-smelling, as well as a shrub whose gray-green leaves looked a little like spruce needles. I could tell just from the smells that these must be medicine plants of some sort. I longed to know what teas and poultices could be made out of them and what ills they might cure. Just then a coat woman came out of the door into her yard. She flung some grain she carried in her apron into the bird box, crying, "Chickabiddy, chickabiddy, chuck, chuck, chuck," page 48, in a high voice. The speckled birds crowded about to peck at the food, and then that woman came walking straight towards me, where I crouched peeping at her from the other side of the fence. She was a small woman with frowning gray brows beneath her white cap. She carried a basket on her arm, and she took shiny little scissors from her apron pocket and began to gather the plants growing in the box right below my eyes. As she snipped them, her scent came up stronger to me. I heard her say, "Good day, Lavender," and "Good day, Rosemary," under her breath. I know that coatmen word "good day." It is like our "koi," hello. So I think Lavender and Rosemary must be the names of the plants, and she was greeting them. Despite her fearsome eyebrows, it made me feel good that this coat woman would talk to her garden just as we do. Suddenly, she looked up and stared straight at me through the chink. I had never meant for her to see me, but now it was too late. She was startled, but recovered herself quickly. "Good day, little savage," she said. "Do you care for some rosemary?" And with that she thrust a sprig of one of those plants through that chink straight at me. I gasped with fear, but I took it and scrabbled backward from the fence. I could hear her laughing on the other side. Page 49. I pressed the sprig of rosemary to my nose. What a pungent, clean smell it has. I keep it now in the little deerskin pouch that I always carry that has my special arrowhead made of white quartz and some kernels of mother corn and the gray river rock striped with red that my mother found the day she knew for certain she was carrying me. I know that savage is one of their words for us, but I do not know exactly what it means. I will tell the rest about Plymouth later. The next day. Now comes the thing I saw at Plymouth. I cannot forget, though I wish I could. There were some noises overhead, a soft rush of wings and shrill cries drifting down from the sky. The coat woman within the fence and I, without, both looked up to watch four wild swans flying toward the inland marshes, where they forage and raise their young. My heart lifted to see those beautiful wicoche, those swans, at once so slim and so strong, beating their gleaming white wings and flying home. Suddenly there came a noise, a loud "kwomp," from somewhere behind me. Black smoke and a stinking odor, page 50, filled the air. I saw a ruined bird spiraling down, blood streaking across its breast, and then a young coatman, perhaps my own age, about 100 paces from me, holding the kind of gun they called a fowling piece up to the sky. I kept crouching in the tall grass, and I watched the young man run toward the fallen bird. He took one wing in each hand, spread his arms and flapped them as though to make the poor thing fly again, and called out as if he were a swan, though his call would fool no bird, I think. I have eaten swan, but this bird was so riddled with birdshot and torn up there could be no eating from her, and the feathers were so muddied and torn they could never be used either. Why would anyone kill for the killing's sake? Behind the palisade, I could hear the coat woman crying out. I do not know what the English word means, but it seemed to my ears that she was crying, "Wicked, wicked, wicked." The next day. Well, there you have it. At the sound of the fowling piece fired so close to the town fence, my father and several coatmen, page 51, came rushing out. The boy's elders chastised him for his rashness at shooting so carelessly and so close to the settlement. But I do not think anyone said anything about the swan. After that, I had a long, lonely skull comb from Plymouth. I have decided that coatmen are a very mixed business, as Father has said all along. How can one know who will give you sweet-smelling gifts, and who will be outrageously violent? Péopoir, White Frost Moon, early November. The view is so different at Tandronc, since most of the leaves have fallen from the trees. I can see the smoke of our village fires from here now. Today I let O'Cook follow me. Usually our dogs just stay around the Witous unless someone takes them hunting to run down deer or retrieve birds. O'Cook is already getting to be more like a Wampanoag dog instead of an irresponsible puppy, and I do not have to worry so much about him barking and revealing my whereabouts. He is happy snuffling around in the leaves and chasing after the scent of squirrels and digging at woodchuck burrows while I do my thinking. Page 52. Yesterday, Cedar and her family arrived here at Nemasket. Now we can start to plan some good times. They came a little later than usual this year because their auntie Nogumis was too sick to travel. But now she is better, and we can hope for more good stories. I've seen no signs of those two boys. Perhaps Massasoit and his family have decided to winter over elsewhere. I'm sure my elders know, but I'm a little shy to ask them in. In a way, I am glad. What if O'Cook wanted to go back to being Wamsutta's dog? Here is a picture of O'Cook following me. The next week. Cedar and I have a plan. We are not invited on the usual hunting parties, so we are going to go deer hunting by ourselves. I know we will get in trouble for doing this, as hunting is not considered women's work. But perhaps that will not matter so much if between the two of us we are able to bring home a fat atook. I am so impatient with only, page 53, being allowed to do the dressing of the meat and the tanning of the hides. Father says the coatman's presence has driven the deer further and further away. He is soon going to lead a party of men and boys to some good deer hunting spots that our people have prepared off to the west of here. There the trees grow widely spaced in the old way, and no coatman village is near. But Cedar and I have seen the tracks of a small herd, a buck and three does, not far down the river from our village. We will sneak out before dawn tomorrow and meet at the river with our bows and arrows to see if those deer come down to drink. There is one problem. We have not been taught the proper prayer to make ourselves ready for the hunt. With squirrels and rabbits and ducks, Father has taught me how to ask for permission to hunt them and how to give thanks if I am successful. But there is more to be done somehow about hunting deer. Cedar worries about this, but I told her we would just pray very humbly to Manitou, the Great Spirit, who created the game animals and all else, to make it right. She is doubtful, and so am I at heart, but I feel we must try this. If we are to be sashims, should we too not be capable of feeding our people? Page 54. The next day. O Squant, what a disaster! Why did you not somehow send a sign to stop me? I suppose, you would say, you did warn me, and that you were the source of that doubt in my heart I spoke of yesterday. I have forgotten to ask you for patience for many days now, and there, I know, lies much of my trouble. Well, here is how it went. It all started off as a great adventure with Cedar, and I stealing away from our village before daybreak and following the river. There was heavy frost underfoot, but our moccasins stuffed with moss were thick enough to keep our feet warm. It was very beautiful to see the morning mists rising from the river, and then the bare lines of the trees reflected in the water by pink dawn light. Sure enough, the buck was leading his family down to the water's edge, and with our bows and arrows in hand, we edged up as close as we could. We knew we would have to be very close indeed to bring down even a small doe with bow and arrow. Just then we heard a beaver slap his tail in warning across the river, and all four deer broke for cover. In panic, Cedar and I both let fly our arrows, not very carefully. Page 55. and one of them, mine or hers, neither of us is sure, pierced the smallest doe's neck. She stumbled but got her footing again and kept on running with the others. Though we tried to trail them, we soon fell far behind in the tangle of woodsy swamp that borders the river. Backtracking, we could see the splashes of her blood on the fallen leaves. So now, instead of meat for our families and praise for us, there is a wounded animal running about in pain. We both wept on the way back to Nemasket, and Cedar ran to her family longhouse as soon as we reached the village. Later. I did what I knew I must. I confessed to Father what Cedar and I had done. He said nothing. Another of his terrible silences. He just nodded and picked up his bow and motioned me to follow him toward the river. I showed him where our shooting had taken place, and he waved me back toward the village while he set off on the deer's trail. I spent a miserable day without complaining, doing all and more than Mother asked. In the mid-afternoon, when the shadows were lengthening, Father walked up to our longhouse with the dead doe on his shoulders. Page 56. He told me he had tracked her to where she lay wounded in a thicket, and then he, mercifully, stole her breath. That is, he smothered her quickly. He says we will talk tomorrow, he and I. In the meantime, I have to help Mother skin and clean and butcher the doe. It will be one of the saddest tasks I have ever done. The next day. Father led me back to that same place along the river where we shot the doe. We sat on a fallen log by the water's edge in silence. Again the beaver slapped his tail to tell his kin there were human beings about, and it brought back yesterday morning to me strongly. Finally, Father spoke. He told me it had taken him a long time to decide what to say to me. He said that he had thought I had learned some lessons already about consulting with one elders and about the need to learn how to kill a creature quickly and with compassion rather than clumsily. But he said, most important of all, were the bonds among Manitos and other spirit beings and the animals and our people. There are old stories that tell us how to behave. Page 57. And there are prayers I have not yet learned, and many other things we do that show our thanks and respect. As he spoke, I realized I did not know about some of those things, those acts already. Such as the way we always burn a bit of the deer's fat on the fire before we eat, so the rising smoke can be a thank you offering to Manitou, creator of all. And I have seen how our people carefully gather and bury the innards of every slain deer that feeds and clothes us, and supplies us with bone for tools, so as to return its spirit to the earth. I remembered with shame that Cedar and I had been so excited yesterday. We really had not even tried to garble together any kind of prayer at all. If we do those things, Father went on, the animal spirit will keep coming back to us, reborn into their new deer bodies, and our children's children will be fed. He paused. But if a Wampanoag omits those things, he said, it is just as bad as when a foolish child of the coatmen kills, oh, say a swan for no reason. And he looked down at me. I gasped then, and I knew that he knew I had been there at Plymouth that day. Then he smiled and said there were certain lessons he thought he must begin to teach me, because it might indeed be true that one day I would have to be a hunter. More than a hunter, a trusted counselor. Page 58. But a great part of that teaching was about the patience I seemed to not be doing so well with lately. You will never lack for fire and for heart and fire, daughter, he told me. But as for judgment, he shook his head and sighed, saying, it will come. The next day, I spent most of the day beginning the job of tanning the doe skin. I lugged the hide down to the river and submerged it there, weighed down by stones, until the hair was loosened enough for me to scrape off. I thought of how the doe had drunk from this same river in her last moments, and I wondered the whole time that I was working whether what Cedar and I had done would keep this doe and the other deer from coming back and yielding their lives up to us in the future. 3 days later. I am still tanning the doe's hide. I made a paste of the doe's own liver and brains and some of the urine that I pressed from her bladder. I spread this all over the hairless skin, and now I am working at a stone back and forth and back and forth. Page 59. Over the smelly hide to make it soft and pliable. Ordinarily I would complain, but I am not complaining today. I must make sure that this doe's life is not wasted. A week later. First snowfall. This one only came up as far as my ankles, but it looked so beautiful, dusting the longhouse and the pine boughs, and it was plenty deep enough to play in. Wootanookanooski and I were out early, romping with Okook. Our village dog loves to follow the delicate little tracks of the field mice and then pounce on the place where the prints disappear because the creature has burrowed under the snow. Okook has yet to catch a mouse, and after a while he gave up and began chasing the snowballs that Wootanookanooski and I and the other children were lobbing at one another. Sil and Gull giggled and rolled in the snow. I packed snowballs for them to throw, and they were delighted to toss them a few paces. I think the little ones will be good at this when they are older. As for Wootanookanooski, she does not have a very good aim, and she cannot make her snowballs go very far. I am trying to teach her how to use her whole arm when she throws, not just the part from her wrist to her elbow. Page 60. But I truly did not mean to hit my sister in the face with a snowball. I was aiming at her back, but she turned round suddenly at just the wrong moment. She splurted and cried and asked if I always had to be throwing things in people's faces. I apologized and helped her wipe off the snow. I must say for once she did not run to tell mother. This morning was the first time I have seen Cedar since our misadventure. I think her family has been keeping her close by their longhouse, as I have been kept. I'm sure, at least, one of her elders gave her a lecture, such as Father gave me. In any case, we had no chance to speak among ourselves, and she stayed to play for only a short time. I hope she will forgive me for getting her into such a scrape. I think we both have learned a hard lesson. The next day. When we walk to the river in these mornings to fetch water, we do not yet have to break through hard ice. But Father says this is going to be a cold winter, judging from the signs, like the thickness of the dog's fur, and how wide the black stripes were on the woolly bear caterpillar last summer. Page 61. The fatter the black band, the harder the coming winter. Here is how the caterpillars looked. Soon it may be difficult for me to get up to Hand Rock. Of course, I can go anywhere on snowshoes, but not as quickly as on foot. In good weather, so there would be more time spent in snowshoeing than thinking. I'll have to figure out another place to be private and stow my birch bark, a place closer to home. But the deep of winter coming on brings me graver worries. If indeed it is a fierce one, how will the feebler among us survive it? I think of dear Nogumis, the storyteller, who has lived more than 80 winters, but who was very ill this past autumn. Most of all, I think of Snowbird, still so thin-limbed as she comes near her first 12 moons. Because she was born in Papagonkiwoosh, the winter month, she was named for the cheerful little plump birds who survive even the toughest weathers, who twitter around our village, page 62, in big flocks in winter. But Snowbird is not plump, and she does not seem to have the energy to be cheerful. Her beautiful big eyes follow me whenever I am working around the longhouse, and she is hanging in her cradle board.